a hand. Please. Put up your hand. I know that I'm telling you everything you need to hear. Okay? So don't hesitate to questions. This is, you know, there are no stupid questions except the one you didn't ask. So talking about how we see on this solid base by the original language. Positively, it eliminates the argument of which translation is correct. Okay? A translation. Now, everyone's favorite translation. I believe that as you do translating or a little working on words and that kind of thing, you'll come to the conclusion, hey, I like this one best. Okay? I'm a New King James Version guy myself. I think it's pretty... It does a good job of translating the text. And remember, that's the job. Interpret. And that's the problem I have with some of the other... Too much interpretation in there. Now, when you get to something like... That's really not a translation, and there's a lot of interpretation there, and that's why I like the message, just because I like his interpretation. But I know it, you know, as far as translation is concerned. Uso, you had a.
Language may be a stupid. What is the original language?
Well, in the New Testament, it's Greek.
So it has to be interpreted in Greek?
From Greek. And that's why, like the book, have Vine's Expository Dictionary. They teach the meanings of the Greek words.
There's translations that are word for word, and then others are thought for thought. Are you going to get into that?
Probably not.
So... why would one be better than the other?
Well, the word for word, as close to the idea as you can get.
Okay.
Thought for thought, the problem with thought for thought is that the truth is. And you've got an interpretation, not a translation. Okay? And not that you don't want an interpretation. Remember, your is to move from translation to application. That is what it means, and this answers the question, so what? Sure.
So this the original manuscripts or the manuscripts that people do the interpretations from, where are those and are they available? And they are, let's say most of the New Testament is Greek.
Uh-huh. And then, all of it.
And I don't know if you went through the canonization things and the Catholic and let's just say the New Testament Greek. And I've heard or read in some of the history stuff that there's some variations in some of the original manuscripts, and like, are there like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Say the Gospels, are there what to get originally?
Okay, now I'll answer that briefly. Yes, that was the first session, the one you missed. We talked about that, And that there are, like you say, there are many different Greek versions. And some of them have variations. Some of them have passages like Mark chapter 16, right. a piece of Mark chapter 16 that is present in some and missing in others. We call those extraneous passages. And we talked about how you would never build a doctrine on an extraneous passage because you don't know whether it's authentic or not. Now, I would use Mark chapter 16 as an illustration because the context of Mark chapter 16, 15, and 16 is also in Matthew, it's in Luke, it's in John, and it's in Acts. So if you were teaching on the Great Commission, I wouldn't teach on Mark chapter 16, 15, and 16, but I would use it as an illustration. And because it does help answer a couple of questions. So we talked about how a lot of the textual differences were the difference between your and our, which is just one mark in the Greek language. Most of the textual, what we call problems, don't matter because they pretty much teach the same thing. When there's a passage like that chunk of Mark chapter 16, or the last two verses of the Lord's Prayer, okay? Are the last two verses of the Lord's Prayer you're right. You're being textual. Right. And there isn't anything that's called a critical problem when you have and the texts are not and it doesn't mean that you criticize it. It means critical in that particular situation means like important. This is critical. You're not criticizing it. It's important. But anyway, and so and many the Greek New Testament that I use most of the time, or used most of the time, I use this one most of the time now because it's an interlinear, and you know, it used to be that I was in the Greek New Testament 10 to 20 hours a week, and I could pretty much read the Greek New Testament from didn't.
Was it the assembled? You know, by somebody like...
Yeah, I'm getting to this. Okay, yeah, right. And it was called the Nestle's Text. And Erbard Nestle, a German critical analyst, as far as the scriptures was concerned, put together in the text of... text, you get like, okay, right here, and you have Greek text here, and all here is all notes in these versions all read this way, like that this one, and this one has this word. And this is called the critical device. In other words, every page. page, and sometimes it'll just half the page. And it explains all of those so that, you know, if that kind of thing, then you, okay, I mean, no, I shouldn't say that. All right? Like, when I wrote a dissertation, I translated answer the critical questions before I wrote the commentary. That's probably the most time I've spent in the critical device. Usually whatever's up here is closest to right or is represented the most number of times. And very often the thing that's down here doesn't make any difference.
It's like almost opinion or...
It's just appearances of different words. And some of the things, well, like synonyms, we'll talk about some of this, because like in Greek there'll be two or three or four different words for a word we translate with one word.
Right.
And so you've got a...
And then they combine some words.
Oh yeah. So especially Paul. He Smith from the word go. He would just, you know, couldn't find a word he liked. He'd just find two words and stick them together. And that's called and when those, like, for instance, there'll be words that appear in Paul's writings and they don't ever appear any other place in the whole, well, it's called a hapax, a hapax legomena. In other words, it appears once. And it'll usually be noted. And then in Thayer's lexicon, it'll say, this is a New Testament hapax. The Apostle Paul put this together out of this word and this word, and, you know, this is probably what he meant. Yeah. And they've spent a lot of time. This is not just something that nobody pays any attention to, okay? This is an entire discipline, all of its own, that people give their whole lives to. Paige?
And those are based off of the manuscripts they find.
Things that are Nestle's. I would say probably by now around 100 years old, because it was. It was maybe not quite. It was fairly new when I first started, but, you know, my high school or my college graduation class, we had our 50th anniversary. So, you know, beginning things are the years are going. Erasmus was a, you know, we usually think of Erasmus, but he was a preacher, and he, about 300 or 400 years before Nestle, we have Erasmus's text, where he took the best manuscripts that he had at the time and combined them into what he thought was representation of the passages that are involved, and it has a critical device as well. Of course, now, you know, they found a whole lot more old versions. When Erasmus did his work, they probably only had 40 or 50. Now they have like 150 old pieces of the things that we talked about. The thing they do, that, like, for instance, have Nestle's text. It's somewhere around 1900. Okay? So then I go compare it with the older version or something like that, like when they found this in the library of the monastery on Mount Sinai. They found a version of the Greek dated at about AD 300. Now, what they do in something like that is basically take some Nestle's text through word by word and compare. See how it lines up. There are differences. And then, and Mr. there's a to me as I'm driving home. But the authenticity and the accuracy and the quality of this have been maintained carefully copied these things.
This
you can.
New King James.
Uh-huh. Oh, good. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. When you run into concepts that give you trouble, then you maybe need to your strong look back to the lexicon, find the Greek word, maybe do some reading there. There's a little bit. There's a little lexicon in Strong's. It's not worth much, but it's better than nothing, but not as good as Vine or Thayer or Bauer or something like that. Okay? So, yeah, this, it's called The Science of Textual Criticism, and there are people who give their entire lives to it. They never preach a sermon or write a devotional idea or anything. They're just given to studying and maintaining the accuracy of the text.
And aren't there more modern day, whatever, necessarily theologians, but critical thinkers in looking at literature and they look at the Bible and are saying, hey, this is a long time ago that they got this thing put together and it's accurate.
Right.
It's reliable, and we're archaeologists, and we're studying on stuff that doesn't make any difference. It doesn't mean anything, and we don't even know if it's accurate or not. But these people have really done their due diligence on the Bible.
Oh yes, yes. The reliability of the Bible, as far as just an historic document, is much more, it has been tested a lot more than like Plato's Republic or something like that, or Aristotle's work or something like that. And I used an illustration the first week. I said, how many of you believe that George Washington lived? Yeah, that's, ever seen a picture of him? No, you've seen a painting of what somebody said he looked like, but it's not even like Abraham Lincoln, where they have actually a daguerreotype, a primitive photograph of him. You don't have any objective proof that George Washington ever lived, except for the books. That's not an objective proof, that's a subjective proof. And yet, nobody questions that George Washington lived.
And the guys like, say, Josh McDowell and Strobel, Strobel, and these guys that maybe tried to disprove the Bible and were converted by doing that work. Anyway.
Yeah, Lee Strobel, right, yeah. Now, I think Josh McDowell was always a believer. I met Josh 70, 68.
He came to Mississippi State in 72 and spoke.
And told you that he was an unbeliever trying to?
Yeah, that was our impression, that he set out to disprove, or he was a skeptic for sure.
Huh.
I don't know about Strobel, but...
McDowell and I have crossed paths quite a few times over the years, and I never got that impression. But you know, now that I think about it, I never asked.
Have you read his book? I believe.
Evidence.
Yeah, and more evidence.
Right.
Right. Uh huh.
I met him in 77. He came to Modesto. First Baptist Church downtown, spoke to the college group.
Yeah.
He seemed very on fire.
He was on fire,
yeah.
This version was based on trying to disprove the Bible.
Hmm. He came across at that point like he was for it.
Definitely. Yeah, he was already that way in 68 when I met him the first time.
I said his conversion was while he was trying to disprove
the Bible. He gave the story. That's what he started out to. It was a bunch of...
Yeah, that was our point.
Huh. But he could have been a believer, and he may have been trying to disprove it.
Translation is correct. Bad understanding of the original language. Okay. Okay, just like, for instance, I mentioned what I mentioned about translations because this is not a Sunday school class. Okay, this is a class for serious Bible students, and so I, that I would not, recommend, and some that I would. In a Sunday school class, or even like at men's ministry, or say the things to you that I'm saying now, okay? I would say something like, if somebody asked me what I think is the best affordable translation, I'd tell you that. Your listeners, and then also evidence in. I'd say the New King James Version. Even the one that just because you think because you've got a Thompson's Chain Reference Bible that has the numbers. And a Strong's and a you there that you can use to get the sense of a lot of ideas that you would never get. And so an NLU is a non-language user, okay? Someone who can't open up the Greek New Testament and begin to. You can still interpret well. Okay? So, let's move on then to words. Up on the top there, there's a little thing. Never flaunt your knowledge of the original or in the Sunday school class. I say, and I teach my preaching students, never say and never use a Greek word in a message off from your readers. Same thing with Hebrew. Don't say the Greek word agape means to care for the well-being of others. Yeah. Like when people use this word, times they meant to care for the, like the word baptism. The Greek word baptizo means, say, if clothes without using it. Because you put it down into the water, you clean it, and you bring it back. Explain this. As somebody honors you after worship and says, what is that word? But you need to know these things. Just because you don't use that information, etymology, what did the word mean to the people that used it? Like I said, no Greek think of doing her laundry without using the word for baptism. It meant to put down in the water and cleanse and bring back. It's a great figure of speech by which we participate in the death burial. So means church. In its primary usage, it just simply means an assembly of people called out into a gathering. It was used for the word church. It was used for the word town. Group of people from the town who came together and discussed the needs and well of the town. With one another. It came to be used for the word church. As a matter of fact, it's that we have church because the word church comes from a Scotch word kirk, which means a church building. And that's where we're thrown off almost with churches being rather than people. It's been within the last 65 years that the concept of church being the people and not the building has really come back into play. It was being made when I was a kid. So we thought of the building. And a lot of people still, all the church buildings that house the churches that we rebuilt, all the church buildings were really nice wedding chapels. They were buildings and just really cute. And like I said, all set up for great weddings and kind of good. And one of the churches that we rebuilt, I found out later on that one of the reasons that they had some of the troubles they had is because people who were in charge of the money were a little tight with it. And I knew one of the I was glad that our church building was such a nice wedding chapel because I had to support my family quite a little bit on the weddings and funerals. But it was a wonderful for a wedding, and it was all set up. The church, the auditorium was a beautiful chapel, and there was a nice fellowship hall, and it was a great place for a wedding. And so many of the brides in town who weren't from our church would come and ask to have their weddings there. And we didn't have a rule, but the rule we had was that if you're going to get married at our church, I do not marry anyone without some pastoral counseling. And I had this interview, and in the interview it said, have you made a confession of faith in Jesus as Lord of your life? And the next question was, do you know what this means? The next question is, if the answer is no, may I tell you? Because anyway, conversion. Oh, almost everybody that came in would say, "Oh, this is such a beautiful church." And I was thinking, "Yeah, you ought to come and see it." In other words, when people are here. Of course, we got around to that. But the ecclesia, church, people called. And of course, it was brought into the New Testament, one of the words for elder. Three words for elder in the New Testament: presbyteros, a man; episkopos, an overseer; and poimen, a shepherd. And they're kind of used interchangeably. And it kind of gives you an idea an elder or pastor or shepherd ought to be like. And that kind of thing. But for instance, the word episkopos could be used for a government official who oversaw the town, or a person who oversaw, like the Parthenon in Greece had an episkopos. He was the building manager. He oversaw the complex and that kind of thing. And these words were used before they were taken into the church to have meaning. Okay? Economy, which we translate a dispensation. An economy, or that which is given out by the manager. Sometimes we think of a dispensation. Theologians who are specifically dispensationalists, okay, they generally know what the word economia means, because that is the basic word for dispensation. Well, before it had a religious meaning, it just simply meant that which is overseen by a manager. And, of course, it's the word that economy comes from. And if you manage your home finances, okay, that's your economia. That's what you oversee. And, of course, it's your family well-being. Well, this word then gets into the church to a number of things. But certainly that which was overseen by the church. Used it. There's a probably won't buy it. But you might find it. No, you might find it. You will find it. Trench together a book of synonyms, and Trench's book of synonyms, and it has that translate, but they have different meanings. All chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. I was going to have this marked and be able to. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and are turning to another gospel. Okay? And this word is the word heteros, which means another of a different kind. Chapter or 15th chapter of John, Jesus says, "I will send." This is the word alos, which means another of the same kind, and and is illustrative of the homogeneity of the Trinity. Okay? In other words, while Jesus was on the earth, he went into heaven and he says, I'm going to send you another comforter. The person of me. The word between gnosko and oida, experiential knowledge versus knowledge from facts. And so, like for instance, let's see. To know that 2 and 2 equals 4. Okay? I know 2 and 2 equal 4. That's gnosko. Okay? I know that the square root of 25 is 5. That's gnosko. All right? But when I put it into practice in an experiential situation, or when somebody explains something to you that you didn't know the meaning of it before, and you say, ah, now I know, okay, it means that it has fallen into place with a whole bunch of other facts that you knew before, okay? It's the difference between experiential knowledge and the knowledge from facts. Okay? A phileo and agapao. Here are two words that mean love. But phileo is the idea of family affection. And also then the word of agapao is I willfully care for spiritual and mental well-being. In John chapter 21, verses 15 to 17, this is the passage that has to do with Peter. And do you love me? Yeah, you know I love you. Well, Jesus says, do you love me? And he uses the word for agapao. Peter says, you know I love you. Another word, and he uses the word for phileo. In other words, do you really care about me and what I stand for? Hey, Jesus, you know we're buddies. You know we're friends. We're almost like brothers. It's a family affection. And Jesus said, I don't want your family affection. Okay? I want your will and your affection. Because when the affection doesn't do it, your will. Okay? For instance, in our culture, you know, you remember that Lightfoot song, I don't know where the feeling's gone. No, I don't know where it went wrong, but the feeling is gone and I just can't get it back. You know? Well, I think a lot of people have experienced that emotional marriage. So they switched from eros, which is, you know, sensual love, to agape. And started caring for one another, and those marriages are still going along because it does come back. So anyway, agapao, dekomai para lambano and lambano, to receive. Okay? Lambano simply means kind of like, oh, you gave me a cake. All right. Para lambano is, oh, my favorite Kit Kat. Oh, I love these things. Thank you. And then dekomai, I receive it. I ate it up. You see the difference? Lambano, sort of. Para lambano, I'm really enthusiastic. I'm not just nya. And then dekoma, I'm myself and I'm using it. Okay. Cross references. Verbal cross references, both real and apparent, like. In Romans chapter 12, verse 2, how we are transformed. And this is a word that means, well, it's the word we get our word metamorphosis from, and it's illustrated by the slug, the butterfly, not the slug, but what do they call that?
Caterpillar.
Caterpillar becoming a butterfly. Okay, cross references, conceptual cross references, and then parallel cross references. You take a passage of scripture that tells the story, like in Matthew and in Luke, or in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, or Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay, when you read those, you discover there's a little bit of difference. And the non-believer will say, see, there's a mistake there. Not a mistake. That's four different people reporting the from different sets of eyes, let's just say. So that we kind of get into that... there's no mistakes there. It's just I said things that you didn't say. You said some things that Paige didn't say. Paige did some thing, said some things that Robert didn't say. Things that I didn't say. And when you put the whole story, it's not a mistake. Okay, so parallel cross references. Then history. It's time for a break. So let's take one. Let's not take a break. Let's finish this up. Oh, poor Paige. Okay. We'll wait for Paige. But anyway, we'll finish this up. We're going to stop. We'll pick up the rest of this. We'll pick this up again next week. And... you'll just have to listen to the recording, I guess. But if you see anybody in our class, tell them these ten things are the meat of the class. Get this and forget everything else, and you'll still be in good condition. Miss this and get everything else, and you'll sort of miss out on it. All right, you sort of miss out on what we're doing. Okay, eat a Kit Kat, or we gotta wait for Paige. She it says, addressing one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to God, always and for everything in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks. And then in Colossians 3:16, you find almost the same thing again, but it's a little different. All right? It's not a mistake. It's just two different allusions to the same. Sometimes you put those things together and you get a little bit richer understanding. Especially if you started with Colossians 3:16, because Ephesians 5:18 has a lot more stuff in it. And also Ephesians 5:18 fits into a context of the Spirit-filled life. And it's very rich. In that concept. So conceptual references and parallel cross references. Okay, come on, Paige. We want to get into historically.
There she is.
There she is.
And I would read this. And for you, I struggle with doubt. And so, and I would, it would appear to me that you could lose your salvation.
Because he was pruning you.
He was throwing me into the fire, you know.
The fire. That section.
You know, I mean, I think it goes, does it go on? Anyway, so that heavy.
Some of the verses that are in Scripture about our relationship with God are warning verses. You need to pay attention to bearing fruit. Because if you don't bear fruit, you're a dead branch. And you will be cut off and thrown in the fire, because that's what happens. You know, every year, right? You went through and pruned off the dead stuff.
But I didn't grow up around branch. I had trees that you could cut the limb off and you would throw it away. Limb and you throw it away. Someone who was a weak Christian and had not had proper teaching, I would, once a year, would have to make that decision again.
When I got taught, I had the same original. I had another person I go through that now that he's amended that. Going, you got to understand the whole process.
But
the branch is going down.
Okay,
verse 6 is pretty.
This is straightforward.
And basically, it's what it's saying is, don't be a dead branch.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't until my testimony is, it wasn't until I saw the fruit that I had assurance. I could say, okay, he's changed me. I was there, and it was First John. Do you love? And I grew up in the South where we were going through a lot of racial problems. And I did. It was like, do I love them? Yes, I do. I love them. So the loving of produced in me the assurance. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I saw my own fruit.
Right.
Like, I didn't do that. He did it.
Right.
Me. And so that's where my assurance would come from, would be looking back. But as looking as a young teenage girl reading that scripture, I didn't leave the church, but I was fearful.
Mm-hmm.
I was fearful, you know. But and I just, God kept me going forward. But I feel for people that, like me, are fearful that they're going to lose their salvation. But the whole idea is, like you say, you're not producing fruit, or if you're abiding, if you stay, you'll eventually get the assurance. I don't know, but that I was taught the opposite.
Yeah.
And so if I'd have read that differently, that different translation, I would have,
They sure, like young trees out here, they plant these walnuts or the almond trees. They don't produce fruit right off the bat. It takes a couple years.
Right.
So you're talking about, and you're a new believer, just realizing that this is not someone that's.
Yeah. But I was expecting, people were expecting me to have had an experience also.
So you were kind of in a Pentecostal background, weren't you? Really?
The experience was, okay, this is, I'm taking up too much time here, but the experience was that I could never tell you exactly when I received. I didn't give my heart to Jesus. He chose me. That was. So I was always asked, when did you give your heart? And I could say, I don't know. I've done it here and here and here. You know, I made those professions of faith once a year. I would walk the aisle and, it was Southern Baptist. And I would say, I guess I need to rededicate my life, because I don't have that experience. I can't tell you exactly the day.
Chapter and verse.
And so a lot of times when you're asked to give your testimony, when did you received Christ, and I said, I'll have to write him a little note and say, I can't tell you the exact day. You know, I can tell you when I was baptized, but I know looking back
that you know who your shepherd is.
I know who my shepherd is, but I can't tell you when. The exact day. And a lot of people say that's, you know, when their birthday is. And so when people say that, I say, oh, I don't know what my birthday is, you know. But I can't tell you the day. I just know that I was born.
Let's move on. It's number two, cut our brothers. Concept of restoration and how we bear one another's burden to restore. Okay. Apart from each or change in their context throughout the scripture and throughout history. All right? So that a word that is used in the Gospels, for instance, when that word is used in the epistles, especially maybe a later one, might have a little bit different focus on it. Okay. Principle of the accommodation. How God accommodates us in His revelation to us.
I want to share.
I thought we were going to go a little early tonight, but guess what?
It's almost 8:30.
I'm in the Bible study for the Vine House, and it is so, everybody's been in a different world. But today I was talking to my friend, and she just always uplifts me. We can feel like, oh, I'm so bad. I'm